This is the third day of this April 2009 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the same text as the previous 2 days, a book called The Way of Korean Zen, which is a collection of teachings by the late Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim. Here this section is called Stages of Meditation. When people discuss the practice of meditation, they often refer to a person having either a superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task. This is something that one reads in Chinese Buddhist texts also. I don't think it's useful to have these levels because he agrees. However, these capacities are not inborn qualities. For once a strong motivation has been generated, then a person is immediately endowed with a superior capacity. So the danger always in categories is that we tend to think a little bit about which category we fall into, and this isn't the least bit helpful. Like all categories, they're empty in the end. In this case, because we practitioners are dynamic complexes of energies, and the way we may be one day, maybe the next day we may be entirely different, in a different category. This is the whole point of practice, is our ability to reshape our karma, our conditioning, so that even though we may start with some advantages in practice or disadvantages, then we can overcome these through the power of Zazen. And you can go the other way too. There is an old text from India about the four types of horses that I wanted to read. This is from a sutra, an early sutra, the Anguttara Nikaya Sutra, and is attributed, of course, to the Buddha. He says, the one who learns that someone in another village is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it sees just the shadow of the whip. The one who learns that someone in his own village is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the hair. The one who learns that someone in his family is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the flesh. And finally, the one who learns that he himself is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the bone. It's true that some people are more attuned to, say, here, the impermanence of life. They're more attuned to the fragility and the uncertainty of the time of death. And this is just about the best asset you can have in spiritual practice is to have an awareness one's the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death, as Dogen put it. Yeah, we could give a modern rendition of this. This is, of course, during ancient times when life was still organized around villages, and people never met anyone outside of the next village. Today we are exposed to reports of not just death, but suffering of all kinds in the world from the most distant places. Some people feel this more than others. Some people are affected by it more than others. It may be, though, that that hearing of someone who died in just the next village would have more of an effect than even hearing of a flood or something that happened farther, much farther away. We can't really contrive to be affected or to be motivated by the awareness of our eventual death. But if we're practicing, then we already have that will sensitize us to these bare facts of life. Or to put it another way, most human beings spend their lives in denial of death, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. And what practice does, what Zen practice does, is gradually dissolve that denial system. It becomes harder to ignore the passage of time and to ignore the uncertainty of the future. Nevertheless, there are different levels of motivation. Some people may leave the care of their parents and relatives and become monks or nuns with a sincere motivation to realize Buddhahood. But after practicing for a while, they discover that the aim of meditation is not achieved as easily as cooling hot cereal by pouring cold water on it. Such persons may become disheartened when their practice does not proceed as smoothly as they had expected. However, a person of superior capacity is able to completely cut off the mind of discrimination as soon as he is told to do so. But for those who are unable to do this, much hardship, effort, and total determination are needed before they can achieve this state. So if we must, if we take this structure he gives of these three different levels, if we, I think it's useful in as much as we understand that these levels are not inborn, as he says. We're not stuck with these different capacities. They're changing all the time. And that it really comes down to not something that we have or don't have. That's beside the point. It's the extent to which what we have, what we are, we can become aware of it. This awareness of the impermanence of things. He goes on. Most people who meditate on a koan intend at the outset to keep a firm hold on it. But usually, after a very short while, their koan disappears and they just lose themselves in delusive thoughts. If someone persists in such a way, when will he ever awaken? Others, after a few initial attempts to hold on to the koan, find that it does not appear to them spontaneously. So they just sit still without doing anything at all. Such people then ask me, "What do you claim there to be? Surely there is just nothing." This is something that I do run across with students in Doksan from time to time, but it's pretty uncommon. It seems to be, judging by how frequently it appears in these old texts, or this isn't so old, but even the older ones, seems to be more of a problem, have been more of a problem in ancient times, or maybe it still is in Asia, but it's a deadly kind of trap to fall into. He says the problem here is that although they tried to hold on to the koan, they found nothing that they could take firm hold of. Thus they conclude that there is nothing at all. But such conclusions are only reached intellectually. Indeed, as long as you continue just to scheme and conceptualize with the intellect, you will find nothing to take firm hold of. But to then proclaim that in reality there is just nothing is mere foolishness. It's a makyo. My exposure to it, and I think I had this too in my early years, tells me that it's a makyo. It's a little trick the mind plays on the student of just convincing oneself, okay, there's nothing to do. How marvelous. Until the makyo collapses, deflates. It is essential to take a firm hold of the koan and to continuously advance in your practice. This is the same whether you are investigating what is this, mu, or the cypress in the courtyard, or famous koan. Initially, you do not understand at all what is meant by these questions. Therefore, in order to fully understand their meaning, you must seize hold of the koan and penetrate deeply into it with incessant questioning. It is really very simple. You do not understand what is meant, thus it is necessary to find out through constant questioning. If you did understand, then of course there would be no need for any such questioning. The greatest disease that can affect someone who is meditating on a koan is the absence of any questioning. It is quite meaningless to simply repeat the koan mechanically in your mind without this sense of questioning. Now, I'm going to take issue with this a bit and say that there is a third way between questioning, which is ideal. If you can question a koan, if you can really sincerely wonder what mu is, or what this is, or who I am, if that wondering really comes forth, this is gold. It's just gold. Because questioning is the most effective way of emptying the mind. You can't cling to something in the mind and be questioning at the same time. Questioning is an emptying. It's an opening and an emptying, which is the genius of it. So once this questioning gets going, one is in good shape. But it's not just that you're either questioning or you're doing the koan mechanically. There is a middle way, and that is to just be absorbed in the koan without questioning, just being really deeply absorbed, merging with the koan, becoming one with the koan. And this is almost as good as questioning. It's far, far, far better than just mechanically repeating the koan. So if the questioning doesn't come naturally, if it feels forced or artificial, then don't try to question. It's not helpful to try to question when it's contrived. Just make every effort to become more and more thoroughly one with the koan, and then almost certainly there will be perplexity that arises out of that merging with the koan. When you first try to meditate, you may find that no matter how strong your resolve is to firmly hold the koan, the mind is constantly besieged by wandering thoughts and it seems impossible to progress in the practice. So what should be done to correct this problem? At such times, you must completely forget about what has happened in the past. For what benefit is there in continuing to think about things that have already ceased? And this includes insights, any insights you may have had in the previous round or the previous day or the previous session. Even the best fruits of Zazen, we have to let go, not think about them. This is a real challenge to most people, especially the first time or first few times one notices something positive, some little new connection one is making or some new insight, it is so tempting to just savor it, turn it over in the mind, congratulate oneself. But to do so is to be stuck. Let it go. Let it go. Leave it behind. Likewise, you should desist from speculating about what might happen in the future. For since it will be determined by various conditions, what can your present thoughts do to influence the course of future events? This is the other common tendency that people have to fret about the future, to make plans while doing Zazen, making plans, rehearsing to go to Doksan, rehearsing about what one will say to someone after Sesshin or what one will do after Sesshin, what one will do in one's next session. How ridiculous is that? but these terrible hindrances of letting the mind dwell in the past or letting the mind dwell in the future. Your sole function, he goes on, during a meditation session is to sit on the meditation cushion, investigate your koan, and awaken to its meaning. Other than this, there is nothing to do. So why do you needlessly waste this precious time by entertaining thoughts about what has been and what might be? Well, we know why, because of the stubborn habit of the mind to take flight into the past and the future. But when we catch ourselves doing that, then it's a very clear choice. Do you want to keep chewing on these thoughts of the past or the future, or do you want to get back to the practice? It's one of the great frustrations of practice to know what you should be doing. You shouldn't be lingering in these thoughts, but still finding it irresistible. Then he goes on, however, as soon as you manage to cut off all thoughts of the past and future, you will experience a state of emptiness. This occurs because at that moment, both before and after are severed. If you cannot reach this state because of an inability to control your thoughts about the past and future, then you cannot be considered a true practitioner. Remember, your sole responsibility is to awaken through inquiring into the koan. Here too, I would edit this statement and say, if you cannot reach this state because of an inability to control your thoughts, then keep trying. Who cares what you can be considered, a true practitioner or not? The real test of your sincerity as a practitioner is to keep at it. Not be thinking about yourself as to whether you're a true practitioner or not. Once before and after have been severed, you enter a state of emptiness. Now, at this time, there is a danger that you might easily slip into a state of just observing the emptiness. In such a condition, you are neither disturbed by sleepiness nor wandering thoughts, but in addition, the koan is also absent. If you just observe the emptiness in this way, you will become a spineless insect. I'm just reading it, you know. Thus, it is a... Yeah, we laugh. We'll find out. Thus, it is a mistake to merely observe the emptiness. Moreover, you should not even allow the thought to arise that you are not observing it. Likewise, try to discard even the idea that you should not allow such a thought of non-observing to arise. We know the loops. We know the concentric circles, right? And finally, you should let go of that idea as well. You will then reach a point where all mental content is relinquished. At that time, since all circumstances are absent, if you take hold of the koan, it will appear with extreme vividness and clarity. By concentrating on the koan in this fashion for a period of a few days, a state of quiescence and vividness will begin to clearly emerge. Notice he doesn't say just quiescence. It's not just the calm. Remember that from yesterday. A state of quiescence and vividness will begin to clearly emerge. At this time, there is the danger of easily succumbing to the misconception that you have awakened. However, this is not an experience of awakening. It is merely a perception of the luminous nature of consciousness. When people do reach this state of emptiness, they almost always, if they report it to me in Doksan, they almost always ask, well, what should I do now? The koan isn't there, but there is this wonderful state of emptiness. The mind is completely empty. Everything is still. The ko, no, the koan's not there. I ask, is what about mu? No, mu's not there. Well, you got to get it back. You have to get your mind back on the koan. Why? Because the state of emptiness will then pass. You have to break through this emptiness, this stillness. It's a static state, and a real awakening is dynamic. It's alive. It's breathing. It's vibrant. It functions. It's not just gazing at this marvelous world of quiet and stillness. It's so difficult when one reaches that state. It is so luscious after hours, years of struggling with wandering thoughts and restlessness. It's so luscious to reach that state. But we can't rest there. Must go beyond even that. He goes on, if at such a time you become distracted by circumstances, what is appearing to you will fade and finally become covered up. I like his use of the word covered up. This emptiness is our nature. It doesn't go away. It's right now. It is the essence of the mind, the being of everyone here. And everyone not here. This is our nature. But it becomes obscured by thoughts. Therefore, make a great effort not to be distracted and instead continue to hold on firmly to the koan. By the way, one of the really joyous things about reaching the state of emptiness, even though it's not awakening, is the realization that this is within us and has always been within us, this stillness. There is a sense of coming home, the deepest sense. By proceeding in this way, that is, continuing to hold on firmly to the koan, what is appearing will become even brighter, and after a short while, you will reach a state in which you cannot move an inch in any direction. Even if you wanted to, you could not go forward, nor backward, nor to the right, nor to the left. He's talking about a real, genuine samadhi state. Throughout, the koan remains clear, but you are simply unable to do anything. Moreover, although such a state has been reached, do not allow even the tiniest thought of having realized anything to occur. Such thoughts are a disease of the mind. Instead, in utmost earnestness, hold firmly to the koan and continue with the meditation. So again, each step we are tempted to stop and admire the view. It's almost irresistible. And if one does it very briefly, then there may be nothing lost. But the longer you linger there, just beholding this new state that is beyond all states, the more you run the risk of backsliding. With such efforts, you will find that even without consciously raising the koan, it will be present of its own accord. And without consciously thinking of the koan, the thought of it will always be there. At this time, when you sit, the koan sits. When you stand, the koan stands. And when you lie down, the koan lies down. When this occurs, you can truly say that the koan is present everywhere and that the practice is progressing well. Nevertheless, you must continue to persevere diligently, for there is still the danger of regressing. Upon reaching such a state, it is important to consult a wise teacher about how to proceed further with the practice. Because on the one hand, it is easy to mistake such experiences for an awakening, and on the other, you simply may be at a loss as to what should next be done. Now, a wise teacher in this case is one who is able to clearly show the way ahead so that your practice can progress. However, there are some teachers who, through a lack of understanding, will tell you to select another koan at this point. But this is not good advice, and such persons are unwise teachers. At this time, that which stands between you and awakening is as thin as a single sheet of white paper. At this time, you need to proceed with the same keen determination and enthusiasm as a beginner. Now the moment has come to raise the final resolve. At the outset of the practice, your resolve can be compared to soaking the straw with which to make sandals in water. I'm just reading what it says. Now, as the practice approaches its goal, your final resolve must be similar to that of someone who has to slash through an impossible knot with a single stroke of his sword. All other concerns must be indiscriminately cast aside. If you are to die, then you will die. If you are to live, then you will live. Through developing such determination, the task can now be completed within 1 week. Thus, realizing this to be a very critical moment, you should prepare yourself with all intensity for one more bout. This, then, is the final resolve. When your absorption in the koan becomes particularly intense, your attention to external matters may diminish. At this time, the koan is said to be ripening and the mind starts to become sharper and more single-pointed, like a fine sword. It is vital at this point to pursue your practice with the intensity of an attacking soldier. You must become totally involved with the koan to the exclusion of everything else. If you can make your body and mind become identical with the koan, then in the end, ignorance will naturally shatter. You will fall into a state of complete unknowing, perplexity, and questioning. This is what I was saying earlier, is that that you don't want to try to flog yourself into questioning if it feels unnatural, because if you can just completely become one with the koan, then from that, as he says here, you fall into a state of complete unknowing, perplexity, and questioning. When you have reached this point, you must still proceed further to the stage where, although you have ears, you do not know how to hear. Although you have eyes, you do not know how to see. And although you have a tongue, you do not know how to speak. Again, this is samadhi state, one kind of samadhi state. To reach the place where mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers may entail several years of hard practice. Therefore, it is necessary to cast aside all other concerns and train yourself to focus the entirety of your attention on the tasteless koan alone. Where he says here, it may entail several years of hard practice, or not. It might be hours, minutes. There are no maps for this. There are no there's no way to predict these things. It comes down to one's own karma. Whether it happens very quickly or takes longer. But of course, in our sitting, we are changing our karma. We're purifying it. We're ripening. Our karma is ripening every time we sit, or even not sitting, keeping our mind fully present, becoming one with whatever we're doing. Here's another chapter. It's called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. Although many rivers converge in the sea, in the end their taste is one and the flow of their waters comes to an end. Likewise, defilements and false thinking endlessly flow from the conditioned mind. Due to this, we suffer beneath the wheel of birth and death. But when the mind from which defilements and false thinking flow is completely cut off, the high and the low disappear. Common and accomplished beings vanish. Originally, all is equal. Therefore, the pure original face cannot be assailed. All the affairs of the world are just like dreams. With a single stroke of a knife, completely sever all concerns. Only search for awakening. Not only must you discard all worldly fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning, and cleverness, but the Buddhas as well. You must finish with it all. He's not saying you have to relinquish all worldly matters and become a monk or a nun, but in the sitting, one has to relinquish all thoughts of worldly fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning, and cleverness, and also thoughts and images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as well. One of the sterling things about Zen practice is the injunction to let it all go. We're not trying to worship Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. We're not trying to hold notions of compassion, love, and other matters in the mind, but just to empty everything, flush everything out of the mind, and restore the mind to its original, pure, vibrant, luminous state. And this happens on its own. It's simply a matter of discarding, of letting go of that which is not essential to our nature. It's just uncovering this jewel of mind that has always been shining brightly within us. We don't have to create a jewel of mind. It's always been there. And it always will be there, no matter what happens in our practice. He goes on, an ancient master once said, the bright light of the mind has never darkened. From ages past to the present, it has been the brilliant way. When entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. That's the end of his quoting the ancient master. And then he says, this bright spiritual light, which is able to hear this sound and see this staff, has not darkened even once. Not once has it become an unenlightened one. Not once has it become an enlightened one. For this reason, it is the way that is eternally radiant. Therefore, when entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. Easier said than done, but it can be done. It can be done not by literally discarding, pushing out knowledge or thoughts from the mind. It's unnecessary. The ideas, the concepts, the words, the thoughts, they just retreat on their own as we become more deeply absorbed in the practice. They wither, they recede in the mind, these thoughts that pester us so much, that it seems so impossibly tenacious. But we won't get rid of them if we try to get rid of them. Trying to get rid of them is engaging with them. Don't want to engage with them at all, even in as much as trying to push them away. Our sole business is with the koan or the breath. That's it. Everything else will follow from that on its own. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.